Welcome to the New Books Network.
Tēnā koutou e te whānau. Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm your host, Adam On, of the podcast New Books in Australia and New Zealand Studies. I hope you all are doing very well out there around the world, because our podcast goes around the world. Today we are talking about a very important subject, which is of a lot of interest to me, and we are talking to Dr. Atakohu Middleton of Ngāti Mahanga, Pākehā. She's a Te Reo Māori journalist for Radio Wātea, and she has worked as a journalist across different publications. She's an award-winning journalist as well. And she has been a lecturer at Auckland University of Technology. Now, there was a full description. I always feel weird reading the exact same thing, but we'll talk about her a lot on the podcast. And we are talking about her book, Kia Hiwara, which is about Maori journalism in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Now, Dr. Middleton, how are you?
I'm good. Kia ora, Ed. Thanks for having me.
We will just start with you first. What made you enter journalism or writing?
I think the seeds for that were set quite early in my life. My parents came from what you would call underprivileged backgrounds, but they were both readers. So my two younger brothers and I, we grew up in a household where there was always books. Now, my mother in particular, she grew up in an orphanage in North Queensland where she was educated by the nuns, and she was a big reader. And she was one of those mums who had us, she was always reading to us, always reading. And she had us reading and writing the basic stuff anyway before we got to school. But what I remember about my mum is that she introduced me to this love of words. And whenever we wanted to buy books through the school, whenever we wanted to go to the library, there were no restrictions. I think my parents knew that literacy was the key to getting ahead in a world where they hadn't been given very much. But I remember as a child, I loved school and I loved reading and writing. And as soon as I was able to string a sentence together, I started writing little stories. And my mum, who was a secretary, typed them out for me. So I can remember over the years the typewriters changing as technology changed, but I can remember her bashing out my two sentence stories on her initial, I remember in the 70s it would have been a completely manual typewriter. And then I remember going through the 70s and into the early 80s, it was a golf ball typewriter, electric typewriter. But I remember that she never put any barriers in the way of our literacy. And we also always had good models. You know, Dad wasn't an educated man either, but he read. So for us, there was always a newspaper in the morning. There's a newspaper in the afternoon, back in the days when newspapers were the font of all knowledge. And we just grew up in an environment where there were always books. I remember that we had a set of encyclopedias, American, but that was what was available at the time. And I remember those world books sat in the bookshelves at home for a very long time. In fact, I've still got two of them just for nostalgia's sake, even though they're terribly out of date now and still American. So I think for me, when I got to secondary school, state school at Takapuna Grammar School, that was when I got to sixth form. That was the first year that journalism was introduced as a secondary school subject. So I took it, and it was just reinforcing what I already loved. So the great thing about journalism is I got brave enough to send stories to the local newspaper, which back in those days was the North Shore Times Advertiser. So the editor at the time was the well-known Pat Gundry, and she was really happy to take my little feature profiles of people in the community, who often were, I have to say, friends who were doing extraordinary things, or friends' parents who were doing extraordinary things. So I remember interviewing one of my friends who became an international opera singer when she won her first scholarship. And I remember that one of my classmates, his father was quite well known in the Anglican Church. So I interviewed him, and I just sort of fell into it. And it never occurred to me that I couldn't spend my life writing. So I left school after sixth form and got into the crash course, the journalism crash course at AUT. It was ATI back in those days, Auckland Technical Institute. Back in those days, journalism training tended to take school leavers and put them through a crash course and then send them off to a cadetship with a company. So I did the crash course, which was very full on, and then went to work for the Sunday Star Times.
Oh, it's like a tradie apprenticeship.
It is. And I was really lucky to go to the Sunday Star Times. It was a great grounding. The Sunday Star Times had only just started at that time, and it was really wonderful. I was working with editor Jenny Wheeler, the investigative journalist Donna Chisholm, and my longtime mate Joanna Wayne. I was the junior of the team, and we worked with the Auckland Star, the daily paper, to produce stories. It was a really great apprenticeship. So that's where it all started from, really. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't be a writer.
Yeah.
Bit naive, bit arrogant possibly, but I was just lucky that the doors opened and I went through them.
I kind of relate to some of the stuff there with my dad as well. When we were growing up, we had encyclopedias. Plus, we had the Islamic encyclopedia of through time with four different, sects of Islam. So I used to just read them quite a lot. And for me, I wanted to go into politics and language, but obviously my direction changed and it's not about me, this podcast, but I do relate to reading from the start. Now, you mentioned in the book that it was a bit of a accident that you fell into postgrad studies.
Complete accidental. Yes, I am an accidental academic. Yeah. I might copyright that phrase because I seem to be using it quite a lot. So what happened is I learned Te Reo Māori quite late in life. I'm of the generation where language instruction wasn't easy to come by. So I grew up, my father's Māori. He's from Ngāti Mahanga. As I said earlier, my mum's Australian. So dad was of that generation that pretty much got no opportunity to learn about their iwitanga if they didn't have that close by. It's actually funny, my dad treated his whakapapa as a bit of a historical curiosity, and he decided that the Pākehā world was for him. But it was my mum who always used to say, your heritage is important, your dad doesn't know much, but you should find out about it. So that's what I started doing in my 30s. After I survived a nasty bout of bowel cancer, I decided that my priorities weren't quite right, and it was time to focus less on career and more on filling the gap in that side of my knowledge of myself. So in my 30s, I connected with my marae for the first time and started learning Te Reo Māori in earnest. And I came to a point when I realised that if my reo was to advance at all, it needed to be a full-time endeavour. So over the ensuing years, I went and did, 2013, I did an immersion course at Te Wānanga Aotearoa, and then I followed that up with Māori language papers at AUT.
All right.
Now, as many of you will know, when you do a master's, you do a first year of papers and then a research project. I elected just to do the first year, which was a diploma. It was a postgraduate diploma in arts in Te Reo Māori. So I was just doing it for the language. I wasn't at all interested in research. I just wanted to be a little glutton and speak Te Reo Māori and write Te Reo Māori and all of that sort of thing. So I did that first. So I did that first year. And of course, the first year requires you to do your application for your research year, and I still had to do it. It was part of the program.
So you had to give the idea.
I've got to do it. I was the only one in the class who wasn't going on to the master's, but I was, as I said, I was being very focused. I was looking at the Māori language papers, not the research, but I did it because it was required. I thought that's a hoop I can jump through. So I basically put forward the kaupapa that became this book. And I was just going to leave it at that. But then several people, in fact, got in my ear and said, you really should do this. And so I started thinking, oh, okay. I hadn't thought of myself as doing postgrad. So I enrolled for a master's and went and found myself some supervisors, which actually took a little while because there are no Māori journalism academic supervisors out there. But to cut a long story short, I got about 4 months into the work for my master's, and my primary supervisor and my secondary supervisor both said, no, this is a PhD, and they organised for me to be transferred to the PhD program. And that's why I say I'm an accidental academic, because I look back now and think there was no planning. It was just a case of the door opened and I went through it, which is what I tend to do. So I had a marvellous journey on my PhD. I've got to give a big mihi to my supervisors, Dr. Helen Sissons from the School of Communication Studies at AUT, and Professor Hinamito McNeil from Te Arapotama, the Māori Studies faculty at AUT. They were the best possible supervisors, and they've become very firm friends. And we went on this amazing journey together, led to the PhD, which I finished writing in 2019, was examined in 2020 online during our first pandemic lockdown. And then after that, I talked to Huia, the primary Indigenous publisher, and said, hey, would you like to publish this as a book? And they did. So here we are now sitting here with my book, which I'm very proud of, but really it came about through quite a lot of serendipity.
Yeah, it is. When I got the book, I thought it would be like an academic history, because when I was contacted by Claudia, this book's coming out, I was like, oh, I gotta, because I'm interested in the narratives that go around, and media plays a big role in that, and I was very interested. So I took the book as, oh, it's going to be a academic history, a historical account. However, the thing that I loved about the book, there is the history part at the beginning, but then you take us on a journey of a Maori journalist, what they do. And that started clicking with me in terms of things that I didn't know that a non-Maori journalist faces as compared to what a Maori journalist faces. So that was so exciting to read, because there were tiny things, and there's the level of responsibility that falls on the shoulders of the journalists. Now I'm getting too excited about the whole book, but I really, really enjoyed the book. So
good.
It was not a as you know, history is interesting, but sometimes you have to labor through history to read historical books, but this was not a labor to read through.
No, well, that was deliberate. So I really was an accidental academic in that I did 3 years as an academic after my PhD. I got a job at AUT and did 3 years there. And during my PhD and after, I came across some absolutely impenetrable papers, and I realised that for some academics, writing poorly or writing impenetrably is a sort of an act of keeping people out. A lot of writing is not inclusive, not academic, and I made sure that my PhD was accessible, and what that was remarked on in my examination. What's the point of writing something that's going to be hard labour? So I wanted the book, and like the PhD, to be accessible, journalistically written, fluid, not labouring any points. Obviously the book is not a simplification, but obviously I've taken all of the, you know, in a PhD, there are various academic things you have to show and do. Those are all removed from the book. But I wanted the book to be fun to read, interesting to read, thought-provoking to read. I didn't want it to be a dry academic tome. And I'm really delighted with how Huia took that idea on board and designed it. So it's also fun to look at. It's an attractive book. They've done a beautiful job of the design. Yeah. And a lot of people have commented to me on how easy it is to read and how good it looks. And for an author, really, that's what you want to hear.
Yeah, and this is a nerdy thing, and it's a, I don't know, people would connect to that as well. I love the fact that you had your notes in continuity through the book, not just the notes for the first chapter, and then in the second chapter start again with number one, and the third chapter start again with number one. I get really annoyed because you have to go back and you have to find the chapter. But I love that in the book. And I was like, oh, this is fantastic. And I might do that for my PhD. I want to talk to my supervisor if I can do that.
Yes, you should. That's how I did. I don't know why you would make it harder for people to navigate their way to the footnotes by starting again with one at the beginning of a chapter. I mean, it's far easier just to go from one to 200 or something right at the end of the book. Far easier. It takes a little more work at the end to make sure everything matches up, but that's my job to check all of those things.
To start with history, one thing that clicked with me in terms of journalism and how it started in New Zealand, both Pākehā journalism and Maori journalism. You mentioned that it was mainly tools of propaganda and putting one's point of view out. They were not actual journalists, or you can say trained journalists. How do you think, is it a common thing in the world, in new countries, that this kind of thing happens? Or was it very specific to New Zealand because they were, after the treaty of Waitangi was signed, there were two point of views coming out?
I think, I'm not an expert on what happened elsewhere, but we in New Zealand, Aotearoa New Zealand, we inherited the British tradition of the newspaper. Now, when newspapers started, they tended to be run by people with money and a point of view that they wanted to push. So journalism as we know it now, as a conduit to serve the public that relies on accuracy, balance and fairness, that's a relatively, well, that was sort of a late 1800s conception of journalism. Journalism at the beginning tended to be politically motivated or motivated because somebody wanted to spruik their business. So in the beginning, newspapers, when they first started in New Zealand, if you look at the different class of newspapers, we had the government newspapers, which were basically aiming to tell the whole country what the government thought and why Māori should behave more like Pākehā. You also had businessmen, often wealthy Christian businessmen who ran newspapers to Christianise the population. And then you also had a bit later in the piece, once Māori got hold of printing presses, independent newspapers, which often were pushing back against the rhetoric coming from the other two sorts of newspapers. So what you get at the time is, if you look at the newspapers from the 1840s on, they were essentially propaganda organs, pushing people's points of view. And back in those days, of course, the newspapers were apart from word of mouth, were the only source of information. This is pre-radio, anything else like that. So it was vigorous. You know, these were vigorous battlegrounds. Mm-hmm. It took a little bit later. The professionalisation of the press came later in the 1800s, but, you know, basically in the back in the day, it was if you had the personnel and you had the money, you could do anything. A lot of the early newspapers were actually printed by Reo speaking Pākehā.
Ah. And you also mentioned that there's the private printers, and then there's the government. And then there's a Māori printing press that comes in. You said that there might be this hidden connection between the Pākehā private or the church papers and the government papers, because both had a similar kind of goal in terms of amalgamation, civilization. Did that continue? What I'm trying to say here is that was there like a secret partnership going on?
No.
Oh, okay.
No. I point out, actually, I'm just trying to find. Here we go. I'll read you the paragraph from the chapter. It's tempting when looking back at the collective power of the 19th century newspapers through a post-colonial lens to see collusion between the Pākehā-run papers and the Crown to promote Māori deculturation. There was certainly some sharing of information, particularly from the government to the church and private papers, but no evidence of an agenda. The publishers shared the belief that Māori would do better if they behaved more like Pākehā, and their newspapers echoed that conviction. Mm.
Yeah, it's quite interesting that, and it does continue the tradition of. It's a bit unprofessional as well. It's not. It's more of a propaganda.
It's the air of propaganda. It's if you have the most money, you can buy the loudest voice.
Yeah, now with this is a question from our conversation, in terms of moving on to the. Being fair and balanced in terms of reporting, I sometimes feel that is unfair for one of the parties. So, for instance, if there is reporting in, the reporting that is happening right now in Gaza, in Israel, and when we happen here. So, in providing an equal space to both parties, sometimes it seems unfair because one is a party which is enforcing their will on the other party. Do you think that that movement in professionalization is a good move forward from the propaganda times?
Oh, absolutely. But the professionalization was happening by the late 1800s. So the tenets of journalism as upholding fairness, balance, and accuracy, they've been going on for a very long time now. Now, to answer to your question, the job of the journalist is just to lay out the arguments. A good journalist or good journalism or a good media outlet, they basically go into, the journalists go into whatever co-pupper it is, and they talk to all the parties involved. Things are invariably he said, she said, black and white. Yeah. Invariably there's a lot of grey. But their job is to just present the facts so those who are listening or consuming the news can actually make their own decisions. We are seeing a little bit of a turn at the moment towards journalists to shape the narrative a bit too much. In journalism, we talk about a tight discourse and a loose discourse. A tight discourse is where the journalist essentially shapes things so you are forced to think only down one direction. You don't have enough information. You have to sort of follow what they say. A loose discourse is much, it's actually critical. You put all the information out there. You don't tell people what to think. You let them assess the evidence and come to their own conclusions. And of course, their own conclusions will be coloured by the lens through which they're looking. But it's really important that journalists don't get in the way. We're seeing journalists getting in the way of the narrative now, or putting themselves in the narrative, and a certain celebrification of the journalists, which I do have a problem with. At the end of the day, as journalists, it's not about us and what we think as journalists. It's about presenting the information and making sure it's accurate and it's fair and it's balanced. If you want to write an opinion column, it should have opinion in massive letters above it.
Yeah, it's I feel that it's an Americanization of journalism within New Zealand. It hasn't been exactly the same, because a lot of the news programs that you see in CNN or in even BBC now, there's the presenter or the anchor person will have a monologue. It's like an editorial in a newspaper, and then they go on to the items and interviews, etc. It hasn't really started here as well, but you are correct that there's a bit of a, and the celebrification of journalists, I feel a little bit uneasy about that, because then you start listening to the journalist rather than the co-papa that they are trying to talk about.
I want the journalist to get out of the way. The journalist, as I say, and I'm not being old school in saying this, the journalist is a conduit for information, because the journalist is where we aren't. So the job of the journalist is to present the information as cogently and as clearly as possible to the world so we can get a handle on what's going on. It is not the journalist's job to block our view. It's a journalist's job to enable us to see what's going on. So I really have a problem with journalists who editorialise. That's not journalism. You're becoming something else and it's not journalist.
Yeah. And you can just call yourself as a commentator, I suppose, if you are a commentator.
Well, if you're a commentator, I'm certainly not going to think you're going to provide me the service of a journalist.
Exactly. This comes directly to the point that I was trying to get to in terms of journalism, especially Māori journalism in Whakaata Māori and Radio Waitea. Is it easy, or is it very, very hard to present that as a fair and balanced, I shouldn't be using fair and balanced as Fox News, fair assessment of the events when you are belonging to a certain EV and you are reporting to from it, or you are belonging to a certain hapū and then you are reporting for it? How, you have mentioned it in the book as well, but I would like to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, so
well,
what you're talking about is how do you divorce your personal feelings from a kaupapa? At the end of the day, as a journalist, you're not to be a cheerleader for either side. Now, one of the things the book goes into a lot is how a lot of people think that Māori journalism is there only to tell positive stories about Māori and ignore all the negative stuff. That's not journalism. And in fact, I don't even think it's Māori. We come from a long tradition of people debating the good, bad and the ugly in public. Journalism is no different from the whai kōrero of old, where people would lay out their points of view. The thing is that Māori journalism performs the same role as any other journalist does. It's about reporting on issues of public, here, Māori interest, in a fair, accurate and balanced way. I think that because so many Māori have been, because as Māori we've been vilified by the press for so long, and sometimes still are, though it happens less these days, I think there's a feeling that that no media is trustworthy, and that's also extended to Māori media, which is a shame. You know, several hundred years of being pilloried in the press has made some Māori very mistrustful of any journalists. But the job as a Māori journalist is to still report on what affects the Māori world. Now, that will be slightly different things, because obviously we have slightly different perspectives on the world, and we work within different structures if we work, say, in iwi politics or an iwi university. But at the end of the day, it's not our job to overhype something or underreport something else. It's our job to look at what issues are affecting numbers of our people and report on those, and report on them fairly and without fear or favour. That is difficult for some young journalists coming into the field. They don't feel that they can ask hard questions of their elders. But if their elders are looking after public or iwi money, well, they have to be exposed to scrutiny, just like everybody else.
There's a great case study in the book, which I will not mention. People will have to buy the book and read it. Kuhangareo Trust Board story that came out. So with the problems of representation, but then also you talk about the responsibility as a guardian of the language. How heavy is that burden on a Māori journalist? Because you present great examples in there in terms of, and you talk to several journalists about their journey and how they use it and how they present their words, and how different TV channels, different programs have become bastions of producing new words. So I always feel that I think the non-Māori journalists do not have that burden as being the bastions or the guardians of the language or the presenters of the language, which Māori journalists have.
Well, what your listeners need to know is that Māori language journalism is actually funded indirectly by the state. So Māori language revitalisation is funded by the state under essentially tiriti provisions. Particularly the Māori Language Act of the late 80s, and then a case that was called the Broadcasting Assets case. So essentially what we have is a landscape in which the government provides funding to provide a language scape that helps te reo Māori thrive, and part of that language scape has to be journalism. So journalism is funded because it's an essential part of showing the language in use, but it also serves a social purpose, though the funding is about language revitalisation. So when you go into Māori language journalism, you're aware of you know, where the funding comes from, but you're expected to perform like a journalist in your reporting. Interestingly enough, though, because of the state of te reo Māori often is the new subject. Revitalisation, kaupapa are often the subject. But there's also an added burden. If you work in English language Māori journalism, there's not a vast amount of that beyond, well, actually, Māori language journalism is pretty much fully funded. There are different funding sources. You'll see Māori journalism across the Māori sector and the mainstream sector. But if you work in Māori language journalism in particular, you're often having to find fluent speakers in a pool that's not huge.
Yeah.
So, for example, the funding comes with strings attached. So, example, if you're Te Karere and you're getting funding for Te Karere, which is more than $1 million a year, you have to have each of your stories has to be 80% in Te Reo Māori. So the difficulty there is you're having to try and find people who can actually speak to the kaupapa. Now, sometimes you'll get the language expertise and subject expertise in the same person, but quite often you won't. So then you have to make decisions about whether you interview that person in English and reduce the balance in your links and your intros, or whether you help them work out what they want to say, not what to think. And you encourage them. So Māori language journalists in particular find themselves encouraging people to use the language that they have. And in a way, they become agents of language revitalisation, which would never happen to a mainstream English journalist. You know, everyone's an English speaker. But if you're a Māori language journalist, you are paid to be an agent of language revitalisation, and you are often in the position of having to support people. Now, we are very aware that those of us who have Te Reo Māori have a responsibility to support others, because learning Te Reo Māori as an adult is hard.
Yeah.
And we want to make sure that any interactions we have with people where we encourage them to use what reo they have is mana enhancing. That's really important. So I found in my own experience that there are things you do differently in Māori language journalism because you want to support people. So you may give them a bit more of an idea of the questions you're going to ask. You might promise to edit out any retakes or stumbles. You might just help them with some words. You might actually, they might stop and say, what's the word for? And that's absolutely fine. And so I think when you're working in Māori language journalism, there's a bit more care around the language. But of course, politicians don't get any quarter for that either. I mean, politicians are the people that we're spending most of our time monitoring. Yeah. So I don't think we tend to do that for them. A lot of our a lot of our politicians are fluent speakers, our Māori politicians. But our job with just the ordinary people in the street, the ordinary people in our stories, is to support them to use the language they have. Now, even if it's not perfect, that doesn't matter. What I found in my research is that the journalists are more interested in people being able to get the message across. They're less interested in perfect fluency than the ability to get the message across. And as one of the producers in the book says, sometimes you'll come across really fluent speakers who just don't explain themselves very well.
Yeah.
So you're really working with what you have. If I think about my own experience, I think the best interviews that I got out of people were always ones where I was very clear about what the topic was. And I also always asked a question again or in a different way if I needed them to have another go. So there's a certain amount of supporting people around the language, but I'm really clear, as are the journalists in the book. You can help them work at what they want to say, but what they want to think, that's not your domain. You're not trying to influence what they're thinking. You're just helping them find the words to clothe their thoughts.
Is that different from mainstream journalists and how they deal with their interviewees?
Well, generally, English language journalists are dealing with people who are also fluent speakers. Mm. They're not going to be dealing with kids who maybe haven't spoken a lot of English. They're going to be dealing with competent adults, generally, who are fluent English speakers. So it's very unlikely they're going to have to worry about that. I'm sure all journalists come across the odd interviewee who doesn't speak English fluently, but it's the same thing applies. If someone can get their message across, perfect fluency is less important. I can think of a lot of times in my career, because I've always done a lot of work in diverse communities. I used to do a lot of work in the Chinese and Muslim communities when I was at the Herald. I was their first diversity reporter. And the most important thing is just making sure that you've created a space that's as comfortable as possible for people to communicate, and just double check if you need to check their meaning. But for most most mainstream English language journalists, it would be very rare that they would have to worry about that. They're often dealing with institutional heads or politicians or people who are very, very, very fluent, very loquacious, very articulate.
So one thing that comes to mind talking about this. So as a Muslim in Aotearoa, and even after, man, I was in the UK, in Pakistan as well, after 9/11, you come into a defensive position always. You're always trying to explain away the stuff that comes out of your community, or be at a defensive position in terms of whatever happens when you speak. You feel like you are the representative of the communities. For instance, I remember when Charlie Hebdo happened, and a friend asked me that, what do you think of this? And I always felt this weight that now I'm speaking for my community, even though I might have an individualized view. So it becomes really hard that you are the representative, and I felt that when the event happened in Auckland, the supermarket stabbings, people would ask me, so what do you think? And then I always felt that, oh, what should I say, because I have my whole community behind me. So is that behind me that I'm defending. Is that something that is felt by Maori journalists as well?
No Maori would profess to speak for all Maori. We're all individual people. We're all different. And anyone who does that or claims that they can speak for all Maori is what we call a mana muncher.
Ah, right.
Yeah, mana muncher. Just BS. But look, I cannot and would not profess to speak for other Maori, nor would I profess to be an apologist for all Maori. The problem is that there are some people out there who think that the other, we're talking about the way they other, groups that are not like them, when they in the course of othering groups, they tend to think that we're all alike, all homogenous, when we're all actually very different. Mm. So I find it quite peculiar. I don't think anyone thinks that, say, one Pākehā New Zealander can speak for all Pākehā New Zealander, but that's all Pākehā New Zealanders. But that seems to be put on minority groups. I find it quite peculiar.
Yeah,
you people.
Yeah,
that you sort people. Of thing. You people. Look, there are so many ways to be Māori. There are so many Māori life ways out there. All I can tell you about is mine. And as a journalist, I think we're very mindful of that. We meet so many people all the time. We're very privileged. We get access. Privileged access to so many lives and stories, and I think we realise just how diverse our own community is, and that would tend to militate against any sort of lazy stereotypes. I can't tell you what all of my cousins down at Maumarae think. They're all individual human beings with their own experiences and their own conclusions to draw.
That's very interesting. I think it can change my. I'm not a journalist, but I can. Kind of change my view of that, because I always feel people ask me questions, something happens, even though I'm not a journalist, and then I always say that I'm not even, you know, I'm a Muslim, I'm not even following Ramadan, I drink beer, I eat bacon, but when people ask the question, it's still my community, and then you are like, okay, and I know if you take it somewhere and you can say that, oh, Muslims think this way. So
I think I think that says more about the person asking the question than it does, say, people like you and I from minority communities. I think the thing is that those sorts of questions stem from ignorance, from this idea that we are all, that any community is the sum of its stereotypes.
Yeah.
That's not the case. And so I think in those sort of situations, I would like to say, well, I can't speak for the entire community and actually put it back on people. And just push back. I mean, I've never actually been asked to speak on behalf of all Māori or been put in that position where I was seen as knowing how all Māori would think. But I think it's really important to point out that actually I can't speak for a whole community. I'm just one member of it.
Mm.
And maybe, I think maybe encourage them to think a little more broadly.
Yeah, I've seen recently there's a bit of a tiny scandal brewing up in Wellington with some laws that they had passed. And I was following the narrative through one channel that I wouldn't name. And I was like, oh, my God, this is going to start again. But anyway, we'll move forward.
Yeah.
The one thing that I really, really love that I never noticed because on my journey to I'm learning Te Reo Māori as well. I'm level 3 at Te Wānanga Awanui Rangi, doing immersion there. So we have a requirement of immerse ourselves for like 15 hours a day in anything Te Reo. So I watch, I listen to Tāringa podcast, and I'm watching Te Karere a lot. But reading your book, it really helped me just decipher the subtitles, because the importance of whaikōrero and how journalists use it to enhance the mana of their kōrero was fascinating, because it kind of connected me to Pakistan. In Pakistan, when a lot of Urdu-speaking journalists, they will sometimes will say a couplet at the beginning, or maybe we'll have a Arabic prayer at the end if somebody has passed away. So I found that really, really fascinating, and I found that very different from mainstream journalism.
Yeah, well, there's an interesting cultural difference here, which I flesh out in the book. So essentially, proverbs and sayings in English we tend to regard as cliches. So right from the beginning of our training in journalism and anywhere in the English-speaking world, we're told not to use proverbs. So you can probably think of all sorts of proverbs, like the early bird gets the worm, all of those sorts of things. If you use those in your scripts or in your stories, they're going to be cut out because they are seen as just cliched and overused. But in Māori language, it's very, very different. So in our proverbs, all proverbs contain wisdom, but in the Māori world, we don't regard them as hackneyed or overused. Mm. We regard them as guidance from the tūpuna kua tuku iho, things that have been passed down to us, and they are sources of wisdom that connect us back through the generations. So we use whakatauki Māori language proverbs all the time, and they add relish, they add a bit of kinaki to the kōrero, and they also connect us through space and time. They connect us with all those other people who have used that phrase, and it connects us back to, if it's a whakatauaki, it's a saying from a named individual. Mm. It connects us back to that person's life and time and the context in which that whakatauaki was uttered. So we've got some amazing ones. And that was actually, I have to say, so that chapter, it's called Tihei Māori Ora, Elements of Whai, Kōrero and News. That's my favourite chapter by far, because I was aware that this was going on, but no one had actually written about it. And I absolutely was like a pig in mud, just going through all of the radio and TV bulletins that I had, and just picking out the whakatauki and how they were used.
Because if you read the examples, so reading the examples there, and then I went, I said, okay, now I'm noting it, because I'm trying to learn as well. I'm noting it where the subtitle is different than what is being said in the end. And I found that really, really fascinating. And I think this was one of my favorite chapters as well. But actually, the favorite chapter.
Because, well, I'm a language nerd. So, you know, as you know, I told you about my accident, me being an accidental academic. I fell into this through language, my love of the language, my love of te reo Māori. And so this was my favorite because it sort of summed up what I love so much about te reo Māori and journalism. You know, this was my absolute, I think I realised I love this chapter because it combined two of my great loves, my career as a journalist and my love of te reo Māori. So I absolutely adored analysing the bulletins to see what was being said and how. So in fact, there's a version of this that exists in a paper online, and I have to say that's had masses and masses of downloads. So it's one of these things that seems to be very useful in education settings, looking at how the language is being refashioned for news. But it's interesting. I'll read this. There's actually a quote here about the place of whakatauki, and if I can find it, dear listeners, I am just having a look to see if I can find this quote, but it's summed up absolutely beautifully.
I also feel that besides whakatauki, the usage of kiwaha, which I don't consider them exactly as idioms, but they are words which don't literally mean what they mean, but they mean what they mean.
Yeah.
So, and I've started noticing those as well being used in, not in news too much, because my language capability is not that high yet, but in TV programs and children programs as well.
Yeah. Well, look, I've just found this sentence about whakatauki, so I'll just read it out. Now, this is by, this quote actually comes from a paper by no less Shane Jones.
Oh.
Back when he was a student, and Dame Joan Metiger, clearly they were working together. Mm. So they talked about in their paper at whakatauki, so I've said in my preamble, whakatauki are short, highly informative, expressive and memorable, and in an oral society are a vital way to memorize and pass on knowledge. Apparent simplicity hides great depth, and this is their quote. While they often appear to be simply recording observations about nature, they are in fact talking about human beings and their interactions. They operate through analogy. For this purpose, they call on a rich repertoire of metaphors which evoke vivid mental images and lend themselves to visual expression. A large number of these metaphors are drawn from the world of nature, but they also include the things humans make, like ropes, cloaks, houses, and canoes. So for your listeners who aren't aware of all of this, I'll give you an example. So there's a really well-known whakatauki that says, it basically runs ka mate kāinga tahi, ka ora kāinga rua. And it basically means literally one dwelling is overrun, but the second is secure. Now, the various interpretations of this all boil down to having two ways to achieve something. Probably more literally, given that this was first recorded in 1857, it was probably talking about the need to have two plantations in case one failed, or a second dwelling place as a refuge. In English, we talk about having two strings to your bow. If you put having two strings to your bow in an English language text, it would probably be excised. But in this case, in the book, I talk about how there's a story, it's a radio story, it's a Radio Wātea story, and it talks about how Māori TV is moving from its original base in Newmarket out to East Tāmaki. And so the news story opens by saying, ka mate kāinga tahi, ka ora kāinga rua. One dwelling is overrun, but the second is secure. And then it goes on to say, tomorrow is a big day for Māori television, they're moving to their new home. So that's a saying that's been around since 1857, if not earlier. It was recorded in writing in 1857. So basically what we end up with then is, in English, their first home has outlived its usefulness, but another home is ready. It's a big day tomorrow for the staff of Māori Television. Their new home in South Auckland will be opened. So in journalistic terms, the whakatauki is used as a drop or delayed intro. So the point's not made straight away, but it makes you prick up your ears and go, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
That's a phrase I know. And with these phrases comes a whole host of allusions. So it can be a really powerful way to, it's a really powerful shortcut, I think.
I really like the Colin Meads example as well, how you end a news item when talking about someone who has passed. And a different journalist had used, you can say, the Maori way of saying goodbye rather than the usual way in mainstream journalism, that they rest in peace or those kind of words.
I don't think in Māori in English journalism you'd ever hear anyone say rest in peace in English. I'm yet to see an obit in English language that does things like that. What we are beginning to see now is that when, and this is something that's fairly recent in mainstream television news, especially TVNZ, Radio New Zealand, News Hub, I think, though I don't watch as much News Hub, quite often when someone dies, they'll say, moi mai rā. So they'll actually use the Māori version following tikanga Māori, but I'm yet to hear anyone who's died be farewelled on screen with, you know, rest in peace. But the thing is about moi mai rā is, in the Māori world, we need to keep death and life very separate.
Yeah.
So if you talk about, say, Colin Meads dying, you talk about Colin Meads dying and you'll do your moi mai rā, rest in peace. And that's a direct address, because when Māori people die, we directly address them. But then what journalists tend to do, though it's not always the case, is they tend to separate the dead and the living by saying something that translates as, now we return to the world of the living. And that's basically a way of drawing a line under discussion of death and returning, making a separation, and then turning back to the world of the living. So for a certain generation, well, for all of us, I mean, tikanga changes over time, and we don't live in a world bound by really strict tapu grounded tikanga like in the past, but it's still expected that death and life are separated, and that you make that separation quite clear and quite overt. So that's what I talk about in the book, because that's something that springs, that's where the way journalism is practiced is influenced directly by our cultural beliefs. And I loved analysing all of that. It was just so interesting to see how tikanga and what tikanga exists in this day and age and how it's adapting over time. Because Māori journalism is a hybrid model. We've taken the English profession, or the English tradition of journalism, and we've made it in a hybrid model that accommodates our language and our culture. And so journalists are journalists all over the world, fairness, balance, accuracy, but we have ways of sort of Māori-fying journalism so that it is more congruent with our outlook and our practices. And that's cool. I just love that.
You had that three-point strategy or framework, tika, pono, and
taurite.
Yes.
Yeah.
So that is that kind of rules every Maori journalist,
or every journalist. If you're a journalist mm-hmm. and not pretending to be a journalist but actually doing something else, your absolute focus has to be fairness, balance and accuracy. And that is the role conception of all journalists. And if you look at our watchdog bodies, like the Broadcasting Standards Authority, if you get in trouble, it's generally because you've breached either accuracy or fairness or balance.
Hmm.
And no journalist wants to be hauled up by the Broadcasting Standards Authority or the New Zealand Media Council. So that role conception of journalism is reinforced by the watchdogs that well, these are media-funded, media-run bodies, so we are policing ourselves, essentially. But those are the basics, accuracy, fairness, balance. It's got to be the front, at the forefront.
So we're coming towards... Oh, I didn't feel that we were at this point. That's very nice. So I'd like to recommend everyone to get the book, read the book, because it is a fascinating read, and it's an interesting read, and it's not it has so many case studies and so many examples which usually history books do not have. So I would yes recommend everyone Kia Hiwara, Maori Journalism in Aotearoa, New Zealand. To come towards the end, I would really like to ask, how do you see the future? Because you've seen recent events that are happening in mainstream journalism, with newsrooms being proposed to be closed down. How do you see the future of overall journalism and Maori journalism?
Yeah, what's been happening to the media landscape in the last 2 years, and especially the last month and a half, has just been, it's just been breaking my heart, because democracy does not thrive without journalism.
Yeah.
You know, I once put at the end of a column, first they came for the journalists, we don't know what happened next. It's, look, there is a small, noisy, ignorant rump of people out there who like to go on about fake news and all of this and that, but at the end of the day, we're journalists because we really believe in the service that we provide.
Mm.
And we look at countries where the press is not free, and we see what happens as a result of that. We see how many journalists are killed for trying to just provide a service to the public in certain countries across the world. I'm really concerned about what's happening with TVNZ and News Hub. Māori journalism is not quite in the same boat, because it is funded as part of the creation of a language scape to help Te Reo Māori thrive. So it is by law, it must be supported by the government. What we don't have the same level of control over is the amount of money that's allocated to it. So in Labor's 6 years in power, for a large part of that time, Willie Jackson was the broadcasting minister and the Māori Affairs minister. So he managed to put a lot of extra money towards Māori language content, which included Māori language journalism. I doubt that's going to be continued. This is the difficulty. The law is there that Māori language revitalisation is a joint government and iwi responsibility, so it must be funded, but it's the amount that's the concern. We've got a government that seems to be overly concerned with cost-cutting, regardless of what the evidence is, and I am a bit concerned about the amount of funding. Journalism is expensive. It's an expensive business, but it's a critically important business. Journalism that primarily serves Māori audiences isn't a nice-to-have, it's a must-have.
Yeah.
In a country that really believes that it is living te tiriti o Waitangi. So I am a bit anxious about it. I think Māori journalism, once it gets, at the moment we're a little bit short of fully trained bilingual journalists. We don't have sort of long-term, we've got some short-term plans going. We don't have good long-term pathways into journalism yet. But I'm just hoping that the funding that goes towards Māori media isn't squeezed so much that the quality of the journalism declines. Everybody deserves well-funded, good journalism that serves communities. So I'm interested to see what happens with TVNZ, with News Hub, but it's a really dismaying time to be a journalist.
Yeah.
Really.
It is a politicization of journalism as well that I've seen during the past government's Rain, and then moving on to this one, that the Public Interest Journalism Fund was politicized too much. And now, as well, after COVID, with the conspiracy theories coming in, so media has had a bad time. Well, it was having a bad time even before that.
We've been having a bad time since media companies were very slow to staunch the flight of advertising to the internet.
Yeah.
The media, look, I remember being told once in the 90s by a senior man in whichever newspaper I was in, oh, the internet's just a fad, it won't catch on. Newspapers were caught flat-footed, and they're reaping, unfortunately, the very bitter fruit of that now.
Yeah.
What I will say about the PIJF, though, is I was an assessor for one of the rounds, and the PIJF was excellent for getting stories covered that were not being covered, and I'm talking about across all communities. So I was an assessor on a round where we had a lot of applications from various ethnic communities, and they got funded to do all sorts of things. They're doing Indian media, Chinese media, Filipino media. People like to say that PIJF was buying stories, but it wasn't. Political reporting was specifically included, but I can tell you that things got done that had huge benefit to communities, that trained more journalists across all sorts of communities. It basically injected new people and new reporting where we really needed it. I get very annoyed with ignorant people who say it was the government buying influence, because it wasn't.
It wasn't. I mean, because it is. They play on people's proclivity to not read into too much. Because I went, when this started popping up, I went to the PIJF website and I started reading the requirements and the needs, etc. And I said that the narrative that is put out there is complete lies at the moment.
It is.
And it's not like shady area lies. It's complete wrong things people are saying.
Absolutely. And look, if anybody wants to know the details of, say, the discussions of assessors, all they need to do is put out an OIA, an Official Information Act request, which I do quite a lot as a journalist. We do have a pretty transparent system here. But it is disappointing, because if we hadn't had the PIJF, we would have seen mass collapse of news outlets. We saw The Listener nearly go, which was a shocker. That is a really important current affairs magazine. It's an interesting time to be a journalist, but as I said, quite dismaying. I'm only hoping that we're going to come up with some creative solutions in the next few months.
So coming to that, what's the bright spot in the future?
Well, the bright spot is that if you are a journalist, because, you know, you don't get paid very well. Seriously, you will not be rich being a journalist. You work very long hours. It can be very stressful. And with the current rhetoric, people just love bashing journalists. And one of the worst things about the internet age is the abuse is direct and personal. Back in the days pre-internet, when I was a journalist, I might get the odd shitty letter. But, you know, on the whole, I was insulated from, you know, the things people say in the comforts of their own homes. Now, of course, their prejudices all get spewed directly towards us. But what I am confident about is that if you're a journalist, you're often doing it because you know that what you're doing is a really important public service. And you really believe in the necessity of a free press to uphold democracy. Now, as we've seen around the world in recent times in lots of different countries, democracy is under threat. And we really believe in our roles as exposing all sorts of issues to the light and telling people what's going on so they can make decisions, especially important when it comes to power. You know, our job is to keep an eye on power and see what's being done in our name by our governments, by anyone in a position of power. These people are working on behalf of us. They should expect to be scrutinized, and it's our job to do that for the public.
Yeah. I mean, I can talk to you so much about this, but we are coming towards the end of it. But yeah, it's such an interesting topic to talk about, because this has been, see, my introduction to English was through journalism as well, because in Pakistan in the 90s, we used to have two channels. And one channel, actually. So the second channel came, and it used to run CNN, right? And I used to just stand above my dad and, you know, massage his shoulders after a long day, you know, doing eye surgery. And I was just mesmerized by newscasters. And it was the international wing of CNN. So there was not a lot of commentary. It was just news after news after news. And then it kind of opened up internationally, you know, the dream of going outside of Pakistan as well, that kind of ads of Malaysian airline and all. So I always find the progression of journalism through that time, and also that was the start of 24-hour news as well. Mm. And it is sad that it is going that way. If News Hub goes, I mean, my staples of Saturday mornings will go as well, the News Hub Nation. And obviously that has a lot of commentary as well, but that is a current affairs program. Mm. So yeah, I do hope that the future holds a bright light. I hope it's one of those things when they say that, oh, the radio is going to die and radio never died.
Yeah, it's I'm one of those things. Too. We need journalism.
Yeah. So the book is Kia Hiwara. Dr. Middleton, thank you so much. Oh, actually, I should say Maori journalism in Aotearoa, New Zealand. Thank you so much for talking to me. Everybody, you should buy the book. It is fantastic. And you love it. And I think you'll finish it in 3 sittings, I'm sure.
Kia ora, Ed.
So, yes, we'll be coming back soon with another interesting book. Tenakwe, Dr. Middleton. And Norera Tena Koto Katoa.